Phyllis wasn't here, and I said, well, she wouldn't come, and, you know, so anyway. And your brother, or your uncles had, your mother was dating this greaser, Hood. Nick, thank you. And your brother, your uncles, her brothers didn't like him, and you know the story. They basically invited him to either keep his car, which he was deathly in love with. That's not the right phraseology, but anyway, he loved his 59 Chevy, whatever it was, maybe even a convertible, and they allowed his house to continue to date their sister. The car could come to a very sad end or something. So he came in and just not telling your, I don't know if they told him not to tell her or whatever, he just said, I don't want to go out with you anymore. And your mother, of course, was not one to have people stop dating her. She stopped dating them. And I guess your mother would say, or your grandmother would say, she was moping around the house, generally being a real pain in the ass. And this happened in the same time frame that football season and the dance and all that stuff was going on. And, well, yeah, because we met on the 30th of November 1963. And her mother finally told Eileen, I don't give a damn what you do. Get her out of the house Saturday night. I just want her to meet someone or get her out to go do something, because she was tired. And I guess your mother would come home from Star Market and just be miserable. And so they started, Bill asked someone about a blind date. And they, one guy would say yes, and Eileen would call your mother and say, hey, and there was this party that Eileen's sorority at Webster High School was having, some kind of a hayride, and then something at someone's house or whatever. And I guess it started on Sunday or Monday, and hey, the first time it's going to be Tony, and then 2 days later it was going to be Bob, and they came up with three or four different names, and and your mother, of course, never had a problem getting a date. She got pissed and said she wasn't going, and your grandmother said, the hell you aren't, you're going, and that's the end of it. And they got desperate, because it was now Saturday, and snowing like hell. My mother and father were going to this fancy charity dinner dance type thing, and my father had come down with a very bad case of the gout, and he could barely walk. His foot was all swollen, and we had gotten the two, Pat Penna's father ran the tuck shop, or Dick Penna's father ran the tuck shop, and we got it was a tuxedo type affair. We both got tuxedos. Pat said, bring one back clean, and he'd only charge us for the one that was used.
Okay.
And I took your mother or your grandmother to have her hair done, put the car into a snow bank, because I brother used to drive in the snow, and I was fooling around. And it was on, right as you come in on 490 into downtown.
Uh-huh.
They've re-wickered the whole thing, but there was anyway. And as far as I knew, it was like 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon when I took her to the hairdressers. I was going and my dad wasn't. Well, Dad wanted to go to this, and I mean, they had paid like either $25 a couple or $25 a piece, which was big bucks. Probably more than that. If you consider at the time I was making $4.50 an hour, or they were paying, well, it's a little bit earlier now, but it was a day's wages for a union laborer, so, you know, it would probably be more like a couple $100. But anyway, Dad wanted to go bad enough. He took one of his good pair of Forshine shoes and put a longitudinal slit right over the big toe. And once the pressure was off, then he could wear it. So all of a sudden, it's Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and I've got nothing to do. Patty and I are just going to, you know, have something for dinner and watch TV or do something, because it was still snowing pretty heavily. I mean, Rochester can handle it, but, and Dad took the family car instead of the college car for some reason, because he had a college car for a couple of 3 years. And I got this phone call probably 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I guess, I don't know who suggested it, but they were getting desperate. Then some, I think what happened is they remembered, hey, Walter's got no one to go with, you know, he's dead in the water, and of course by this point, Ewing would have probably should have known, would have been around, you know, Phyllis, because Phyllis was in a circle with the football players and stuff. We hung around with a particular group, and it would have gone, made the rounds by that point, and I would have talked about it. Somehow he thought, I guess I came to mind as a last minute grasp the straw, because God Almighty, if I don't have, because there was most everyone, I guess it was a date thing. And at this point, they were so desperate when he called, he didn't tell me I've got a blind date. Eileen's group was having a party and they were short on, they had more girls than boys and they needed some more boys to come to the party. Didn't tell me I had a specific date. Okay. And I would have gone anyway, but anyway. I said, well, that's great, but you got to pick me up because I don't have a car. And he said, no problem. And they'd be there, and it had to be probably pick me up by 5 o'clock, because it was just barely light. And this great big gold Chrysler pulled into the driveway, and it wasn't Bill's car, and I saw Bill get out. So, and of course, it was Aunt Peggy. And you know, said, well, this is Eileen's mother, and so on and so forth. I don't know why.
I think, I mean, was she trashy, or was she kind of, like, I was, you know, I have grandma's version of Peggy, but what was your first impression? Was she, like, pretty respectable
by 30 years? Oh, yeah. I mean, she was, what, she's 30 years, 20 years older than I am. I mean, so she was in her 40s. I mean, she was an adult. When I met her, she was she was still the brassy, loud person. Well, she isn't so much brassy and loud now, but you know how she is. And, yeah, I didn't get, I mean, we went out and they had that beautiful, I don't remember their home out in Webster, it was a lovely, lovely home. And I mean, Sam was a plumber, and you know, that's, you know, we were never brought up to look down on people who, yeah.
Well, I was just curious, because, you know,
oh, all that stuff, but yeah, I mean, I, that all came out later. And
yeah,
stuff.
Like, you know, how wild and crazy she was. I wasn't sure what your first impression was.
No, she was just a, she was Eileen's mother, and she was a little bit, I mean, outspoken. I mean, that's Aunt Peggy, there's no two ways about it. And, I mean, at first we got in the car, I mean, we had no, I don't think she had even gotten the car, and she had backed out, and I don't think she'd even gotten in the drive yet. And she said, oh, they'll make a wonderful couple. And I said to Bill, what does she mean, lovely couple? Oh, well, Eileen's cousin is coming, and I mean, it was kind of like, I don't know exactly how he phrased it, but she wants, you know, you got to meet her or whatever. And I mean, I don't know if he said at that point it was a date or whatever. And I still don't understand why Peggy drove. I mean, Bill had his own car.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he owned his own car. At least his dad had given him a car to drive. But anyway, I mean, we went out to Peggy's house, and I mean, it's still snowing, and there's the, you know, they asked, of course, I hadn't had time to eat any dinner, and of course, Peggy asked if I wanted something to eat, and I said, yeah, and she offered ice cream. And of course, I had braces, had just gotten braces a couple months before, and of course, your mother's impression was I'm sitting there in a Suburban, I guess I had on a sweater or sport coat, shirt and tie. I think I just had a sweater on. I may have had a sport coat on. But I mean, that's, you had to wear a coat and tie at Aquinas. I mean, it was just given. You had no choice. So wearing a coat and tie was just second nature when you went out on a date, if you were going out to something like this. And I had a big bowl of ice cream, and of course the door flies open, and your grandfather comes in his quiet voice, goddamn son of a bitch, it's snowing like hell out there, I don't know what I'm doing out here on a night like this, or something to that effect, and I'm Jesus Christ, who's this guy? And of course, then Eileen comes in, and she's, you know, her pleasant self, and I'm you. And of course, then your mother walks in, and I'm introduced, and she just kind of walks off with Eileen and, you know, goes off to the bedroom and stuff, which, you know, it didn't strike me necessarily as unusual. I mean, I just met her, and it wasn't. Well, I think at that point I knew that I was supposedly, I mean, Bill had to fess up. I just don't remember what his explanation was, because I remember thinking, well, okay, I mean, it's not a big deal. It wasn't the first blind date I'd ever gone on. And so, of course, they canceled the hayride. When I think about it, I don't know why I would have run out of time. Maybe they already told me there wasn't going to be a hayride. But anyway, hayride was canceled because they couldn't get the barn doors open because of the snow drift.
That would make hayride
open. Yeah, plus since it was snowing so damn hard, I don't know where, you know, maybe they were cold and also wet, and maybe they get stuck somewhere. But anyway, it was canceled. We went to someone's house for a party. It was down in their, they had a basement family room. And it drove in their brand new black Ford station wagon with the red interior, and that's the first time I heard Evie referred to as Checkers, or Check, which she didn't like at all. But she was, I think she was at, yeah. And I think she was, she must have been there too. She came along, because she of course would have been, couldn't have been left at home or whatever. They didn't want to, I don't know, Pat wasn't with them, but I think, well, maybe I may be getting that a little confused. Maybe she wasn't, but anyway, he drove us to the party, and we talked all night. Of course, your mother will tell you that she didn't hear a thing I said, all of that, and I was obviously quite taken with her, and I did, during one of the slow dances towards the end, I did get a kiss in, and I was quite taken with her, and she will tell you, obviously, I was a, I don't know, the equivalent would be a geek today, because maybe preppy? I mean, I can hardly be considered a geek. I mean, I played football, ran track, I wasn't any kind of a wonder student or anything, but I guess I didn't dress, you know, I wore some, well, she was into motorcycles, and I was, you know. So
why were you so taken?
Your mother was a very pretty girl. I mean, the initial thing is, she's a pretty girl. Fox, whatever the term I was going to use back then. I don't think Fox was in the boat. But I mean, she was very attractive. She danced well. She was tall.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always liked, I've never, you know how Jimmy seems always to have these blonde, slender, I mean, the closest, that's the one thing about Chrissy. She's not a slender girl. I mean, she's not a waif. She's a. I look at her calves and I keep thinking she really looks like she. I wonder. I never asked if she played soccer or something, but she looks like her calves are muscular. Is the way I would describe her calves. I mean, she just, like you said, she's solid. She doesn't use this. Well, don't take it personally. She does.
Oh no, she's healthy and formal. She's not interesting.
But, and of course, going, I'm sure your mother covered the whole thing. You know, your mother, her mother and father took me home and asked for the phone number. And I don't know if I, and I remember her telling us she didn't have a phone number or a phone. But I don't know at the time if I thought she was just being
joking
or whatever. Of course, she never got a chance because your mother popped up two phone numbers and offered to write them down, but it said I could remember them. And that's, you know, then she managed to, we had a five couple date that I had to pick every, we didn't double date, we quadruple dated. And that was like the following week, because I remember Bill Euling asking me what I thought of her, you know, like the following Monday, and I said, oh, you know, very much so. And asked her to go to, I think it was Bye Bye Birdie. There was a play at Aquinas, and she dreamed up this thing, and I had, don't know if I had to find dates.
They do plays like Bye Bye Birdie at an all-boys school.
Oh, they brought the girls over from Nazareth, I think.
Oh,
No. They, I don't, Aquinas with me, but okay. You know that then. But, you know, I assume they took girls from either Nazareth or maybe even any of the Catholic girls' schools. I don't know if they would have allowed a public school girl.
Uh-huh.
But, they, I think that was the first date, and I mean, I don't know if Eileen and Bill went with this. All I know is that I basically, if you look at 490, 390, the Keeler Street Expressway, Hamlin Beach, and then down 390, basically I circled the entire city because my mother apparently either remembered the miles or maybe had checked the speedometer, and I put 90 miles on the car that she was convinced that I went to Buffalo or someplace. I said, honest. Because and of course you had to pick up the guy. You couldn't pick up the girl first. You had to pick up the guy who was going with the girl, and I don't remember all even in the car then. And of course then that's when I got sick a couple, that would have been like the first week of December, and their Christmas dance was probably like the Saturday before Christmas, and then that, the Decorah, Iowa, came out, because her parents were coming to Cleveland to visit relatives, it was something that I think I had signed up for week or months before, even when I was dating the other people. I mean, she had a much stronger interest than I did. But, the mother, I don't know what it would have been like if the mother had not come along. But put her on the bus, New Year's, bus back to Cleveland at like 1 o'clock in the morning or 11 o'clock at night in Rochester on New Year's. Pat Penham was with Dick Penham. Then I had to go see my mother the next day, and that was something I didn't do before. We'd gone out, and I got the flowers and went out to see her. And I don't know, you know, I think back, there's been a couple times I probably should have ignored what my parents and doctors told me. Because I had the same problem when I was a freshman. I was playing with a pocket knife, mumbly peg, we were throwing a knife, and it slipped, and I put a slit in my leg, took like 3 or 4 stitches right about here on the front of the shin. And they had something at St. Anthony's called the Freshman Mile. And anyone could enter, and it was like, they had a painted strip in the yard, and it was like probably 6 times around. And I was the fastest miler around. There was one other guy who played football with me. And the doctor said, now, thinking about it now, there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't have been able to run. But I didn't run, and the guy that I could beat won the race. And it was that time, and then, I don't know, because I was cleared the day after Christmas, because your mother came to the house with a Christmas present on Christmas Day, and it was really, I had this white and silver brocade robe that some neighbors in California, their son-in-law brought me from Japan. I mean, it was black velvet trim, collar and stuff. I mean, it was really ostentatious and never would have bought it, but it was kind of neat. And I had that on, and I think a pair of sweatpants and a waffle Long John top on. I mean, it was Christmas Day. We were lounging around the house, and I don't think Mary called and said she was coming. She just stopped by the house. I think I ended up jumping upstairs to change. But I went to the doctor the day after Christmas. He said, okay, you're fine. But I guess he was concerned because it was a touch of pneumonia or near pneumonia, and it was pneumococcus, which was it's worse than strep, I guess. So anyway, you know, and of course, they don't care. They're being cautious, which is why I decided to have my tonsils out a few years later. So, and then there was the long struggle. Did she tell you about, I know I told you about the
pages about the back and forth
and the Missy girl from Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Did she tell you about the notebook of poems I sent her?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I feel St. Joe's had a little flip up, you know, one of these little flip up notebooks. And when she was down in the down at school, and it was costing me $12 an hour to talk on the phone, or $6 an hour. I can't remember, $6 or $12 an hour. All I know is I was only earning $1.90 an hour washing dishes and or working in the cafeteria. And I went over to Wedrick's girlfriend's house because she worked at the college but had an apartment. I could go there and I didn't have to pump dimes in. I could just use the phone and then she'd give me the bill.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, I sat there over a period of weeks, wrote her poems. Oh, yeah.
Did that still happen?
Oh, no, she tossed it. But somewhere she hasn't tossed it. If we go up to the attic, I did it in another notebook, you know, when I was just writing it. And then I copied it into that notebook. So it may still be hidden up in the attic somewhere. I mean, she hasn't thrown stuff out. She told you about meeting the girl that told her about her little sister.
Yeah.
We met her on the airplane after we were married. She was still flying for America. And so we met her. She was in Rochester, as a matter of fact. In Rochester, Chicago.
The girl that you were practically meeting?
No, it was her roommate, the one who was your mother's little sister. My earliest memories, I remember being in Seattle at my grandparents' house, and Mom and Dad must went out on the Olympic Peninsula out of Puget Sound, and I had to be 4 or 5 because someone's car got driven out onto the mud flat or onto the sand flats. And someone, I don't know, my parents' car or someone's car got stuck in the mud and the tide was coming. I forget. I vaguely remember that because it was getting dark and they had campfires. And I think we were staying in some cabins out there. I mean, you know, it's still pretty primitive now. And of course, you know, 50 years ago, it was even 53 years ago. And remember trips like that, some of the train trips from Washington to Chicago when on the D&O, which was the only railroad that ran dome cars on the East Coast, and they went up through Cumberland, you know, on the old US 69. We've taken that trip back and forth.
Uh-huh.
Instead of the turnpike, because you come into Cumberland, and that was one of the B&O main line. That was the B&O main line. And I was up there playing in the dome car, and they had a speedometer and a clock. And I remember coming into Chicago early in the morning. Trip to Niagara Falls, test driving how to do the test run because we had a Coca-Cola cooler with the drain in it. You know, it's basically now your Coleman cooler, but then they advertised.
So what did you get? For a test run?
Yeah, because that was the year they were going to go to California. We just got the Nash, and Dad wanted to go back up to Niagara University to see some of his instructors and friends. And I remember went to dinner in a fancy restaurant on the Canadian side. Of course, his dad took us down to where he used to run around Niagara Falls and down in the gorge. There used to be a railroad or a trolley car run down on the floor of the gorge, but it got chewed up from Niagara Falls out to Lake Ontario. It's about it's 17 or 20 miles from where the escarpment actually occurs, where Niagara Falls started. It's come back like 17 or 18 miles. And they used to have a interurban or trolley car run down along the gorge, and there was a
massive... And the Forks is where the river, the water comes, the Niagara Falls.
Falls, and then it goes into Niagara. Well, it's still the river, but it's now in the gorge, and it's much narrower.
It's Niagara River, then it goes over Niagara Falls, and then it goes into the gorge.
And it's still the Niagara River. It's the Niagara River from the time at Buffalo, where it comes out of Lake Erie, and then goes over the falls and down into the gorge. And of course you have that gorge, the water is tremendously, it's probably as dangerous as Colorado River in full flood for the most part. Because if you remember the gorge at the top, or before you get not the gorge, but Niagara Falls, is very wide and not necessarily very deep in places. And all of a sudden you go from something that's a half a mile or more wide to the gorge, and you're into something, I don't know, the water, I think it's going to be 60, 70 feet deep in there. And you've got, there's a major right angle turn along there, and I mean, there's a major, they call it the whirlpool and all that. Because the thruway, part of the New York State thruway wasn't even all done at that point, they were just building it. It was in the gorge and it got destroyed. There was a massive, one year the river froze, I mean it freezes solid quite often, but they had a massive ice dam and it destroyed everything downstream because of course I think the water went up, the ice buckled or whatever, but it got destroyed because he took us down there and showed us where he used to go fishing and so on and stuff. There's all kinds of stuff like that, things, you know, I remember Dad telling me stories when he was a camp counselor, you know, like, how did they eat and stuff like that, but I don't remember, like you said, you know, some of it I don't remember. But, you know, things like going to the World's Fair in Seattle, and, train trips, and I remember what I didn't mention, like, when we went out with my mother, I mean, I remember going along US 30 in Nebraska and her driving faster than a Union Pacific freight train, which moved at 60 miles an hour out there. I mean, it was at night, it was at dusk, I remember the trip, because there was a coal-burning engine like that. They have a grate underneath and you can see the glow of the fire. And of course, it's just that, you know, one of these long twilights in the middle of the summer, probably like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. Just driving along, and we slowly passed the train, not real fast. The train was moving. I assume it was a freight, but I can't swear to it because what I remember is that engine just puffing smoke and the orange glow on the underside.
What was Fanny Walsh like? Did it get some humor?
Yeah, I think there were some hang-ups. I think. That's your mother. Actually, in some ways, very much like my mother, I think. I look at what she, you know, I mean, I was sent to Europe when I was in college. I mean, it was a special deal. It wasn't, we had like 2.5 or 3 weeks because they had this new, they had an interterm. And when they first went to the early start, because most colleges didn't start till the end of September, middle of September. And my senior year, they started like on the 25th of August, so you were all done at Christmas. And for some reason, they decided not to move the second semester up. They had, so there was like a 4 week period from January, well, from Christmas break until early, late January. And they had a short semester. There was a geology field trip out west, and there was different things, and they had a deal to go to Europe, and it was like $600 for 2.5, 3 weeks, airfare, all hotels, and some of your meals. And I went, I don't know if she'd been to Europe yet. And, you know, she has a tendency to really spend, I mean, when Joe came along and stuff like that, I mean, it, through anything, you know, they were always buying stuff for us. I mean, same thing your mother and I do for you guys. I mean, so there's, and, you know, well, I don't need that. So on, and I mean, it's like when my father had his first trip to Ireland, she couldn't go. Oh, she had to take care of Patty or whatever, and Dad went without her. She never did not go with my dad again. I think Patty hurt herself, and that was some kind of vindication, but she never did not go to Europe or to Ireland when Dad went. I mean, she had a wonderful time. And I think she had a sense of humor, and I, and you know, your mother and the Lokis have a tendency to, I remember them making, your mother, your grandmother making a comment about, and I don't know if this was Kay or Dad or my mother, but something about some making a big deal about asking what someone did or. Two pets in all my life.
Yeah.
Both cats. First cat we got was a black and white cat with a white stripe that came down its nose and then went off to the side, and we called her Skunk. Skunky. And actually, that cat we had to haul that cat to California. So I'm trying to remember. She did.
Was it that long?
Well, I'm trying to think. We had the cat in 56 or 57, so yeah, I mean, that wasn't that old. She only would have been 7-8 years old. She came back to New York with us, and she eventually died, and Mom and Dad got like I guess you call it a brindle calico. She was black and brown, but we called her Skunky just because it was easier.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like if we had another lab and had some blackjack.
Yeah,
just like you. Those are the only two pets we had.
Really?
Yeah. Never had dogs. I don't know. Just never had dogs.
Okay.
Okay.
Best friend.
Jeff Kirk in Kings Point. Last time I saw him was probably about 1985. He was a Episcopalian priest in Rochester. In kind of a small world, when we moved back to Washington,
mm-hmm.
there were those, were the names of Campbells, if they were friends of Jimmy's, they had a bunch of boys, and the father was a DEA agent. They had a house up a ways in the housing, in the regular individual family houses. Their next door neighbor was Jeff Kirk's mother.
Really?
Yes, but she was very ill, and I was going to stop in and see her, and it was one of those things with that job at the Pentagon, and she wasn't there all the time.
Uh-huh.
And I never did get in to see her, and I regret it to this day. There's a couple times I should have done it. But his brother, he was my next, I mean, he literally was, their house was the matching house to ours.
Mm-hmm.
His father was some kind of a administrator over at the academy. He was a captain. He was in the Naval Reserve to Shallis Kirk. I don't know what his real name, but they called him. His wife called him Shallis. Mrs. Kirk was really a nice woman. They were probably 10. Jeff was their youngest. It was Donnie Kirk, Jeff Kirk, and I can't remember the middle boy, but the middle son lived in Washington and was a lobbyist for a liquor association or something. So I don't know if he was a lawyer or not. I never did see him, but I saw Jeff in 85. He had a parish in Rochester, but I don't know if because I was working in 85. Well, before Dad died, it was in Pittsburgh, so it was on Briar Patch. So I was the fact that I was in the Army Reserve or Air Force Reserve and working for the Air Force, or he never, we
met in Pittsburgh, there was a 4th of July parade, and he just never clicked or anything. I mean, you know. And in Long Beach, it was Dennis Ponczarek and Dennis Shelton. We hung out, and Dennis in particular, he's the one that introduced me to the Mormon girl. He had a Mormon girlfriend, and she had a girlfriend, and so on and so forth. And it was funny, we'd go, I'd serve Saturday morning mass and then head down to go have breakfast with the Mormon girl. And I saw Dennis, the last time I saw Dennis was in 1978, and he had married, you know, he actually married, he married one of the twins, I can't remember their names now. I had gone out, I hung around with him, but he had gotten married, and by 1978, when we had the bus trip, he had divorced and had a, what were we, in 78, I would have been all of 32, and he had a girl who struck me as a lot younger. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they were married or just living together, and I think there was a baby. I don't know if he had any children with the first girl, the McLaren twin. He was the one that we went out there on the bus, you guys stayed back with Sam and Marge, and get home until 4 o'clock in the morning, the morning of us leaving for that, you know, then we went to Universal, because he sent us, at God knows what time, he said we were hungry, and, you know, he said, is there some place to go eat? He sent us to that wonderful hamburger place down in Belmont Shores, and we had those humongous hamburgers, and I mean, it came with pickle and cantaloupe, and I don't know, and onion, oh, it was really good. And that was like a 3 o'clock in the morning, and we got back to Long Beach at 4, and then of course, you know, then our original plan was, you know, Sam told us, well, you got to drive through Hollywood, so, and of course, you guys didn't want to go to Universal Studios, and we talked to you about it, just wanted to go to Disneyland and go to the beach. Mm-hmm. And then we're driving up the Hollywood Freeway, I forget whatever it is, I remember the road, because you go by the Decca building, I don't remember that, the round building, the Decca Records.
That's so weird. I've never heard of Decca Records. And today, when I was reading about Judy Garland, I heard about Decca Records. Today, on Fresh Air, they were interviewing somebody about a songwriter who worked for Decca Records. And then he just said that. Isn't that weird? How is that happening?
Yeah, well, see, the Decca Record building is right on, I think it's the Hollywood Freeway. I don't know which the numbers are anymore, but it's the one that takes you out into the San Fernando Valley. And it goes right out past Universal Studios, Burbank, the Warner Brothers Studios. And Decca Records building is a completely round building, and it really, in a way, you can imagine a stack of 45 records.
Uh-huh.
And it had a big triangular-shaped thing at the top, which could have been almost like a spindle.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, we drove, instead of going up the coast the way I would have gone, Sam said, oh, you got to at least let them say they've been to Hollywood. And then I said, oh, up there is Universal Studios. And then you guys all scream, oh, I want to go to Universal Studios. So at 10 o'clock in the morning with, you know, about 3 hours sleep, we spend the entire day at Universal. And I don't know if you remember, your mother was cooking ham. Yes, the Hulk.
Uh-huh.
And the Jaws and the airplane. Remember, we watched them evacuate the airplane and all that. And then we must have had lunch or something, but then we didn't stop for dinner because we didn't have time, and we said I think they closed at like 9 o'clock or something. So we all go out, and your mother's cooking hamburgers as I'm driving the bus along the freeway headed out on 101. And I mean, we didn't barely make it to the coast. And, you know, I ate driving, and guys ate and all sacked out, and I found a state park on a state beach, and I pulled over and just parked the bus along with a bunch of other cars and stuff that were there to go fishing or surfing or whatever in the morning. Only I didn't pay attention. I was so tired I didn't realize that the Southern Pacific tracks that we had been on for the coast daylight were right there, And all of a sudden, at God knows what time in the morning, there's this terrible roar and the shaking, and I'm thinking earthquake, tidal wave, and of course, it's a train going by about 30 feet away, and just... and in Long Beach, or in Rochester, there was the Vino Five. There was myself, Sam DiAgostino, Dick Penna, Tom Mooney, and I forgot the other guy's name. Seen clear as day. But we hung out together quite a bit. Well, we called ourselves that because when we somewhere in the when we were graduating, before or after the somewhere around graduation, Sam DiAgostino's father made homemade wine. And the deal was we could come over and drink as much of it as we wanted, but we had to give him the car keys and we couldn't leave. Well, we drank and we walked around the neighborhood basically drunken, shit-faced, and that's when we started calling ourselves the Vino Five. And I stayed, Sam DiAgostino's brother was in Chicago, and he worked for TWA, food service or something, and stayed in touch with Sam for a while, and then I found out, your mother didn't tell me until a while later, he was going to University of Buffalo, eventually became a real estate lawyer, but she was having trouble with some math, and he came over to help her, and somewhere along the line, he made a play. And that pissed her off. Of course, it didn't piss her off when Glenn Corn asked her to go out and just forget about me and thought she'd be interested. She'd be interested in going out with him. And I stayed fairly close to Dick Penna for a while. I mean, Dick Penna's father and his mother were really great people. We stayed in touch with them up until Penna died, and I see Dick at reunions, but I haven't seen any of the others. I lost the other guy's name. It's another Irishman. But he went into teaching. Mooney went to work for, he went to University of Detroit and got into some special program where you can start working on your master's, and by the time you can spend another 6 months or a year, and he came out and he got a degree in engineering. I don't know what his master's was in, but he went to work at Xerox. He's the only one that probably stayed in Rochester. So the guy's name, I can't remember right now, Mike something. He got into teaching deaf students. Of course, yeah, I think he taught. And I think
deaf students.
No,
deaf.
Deaf. And I think he may have taught at the Rochester School for the Deaf, but I can't swear to it. So they were kind of close, and then, but have lost touch over the years, partially because your mother really didn't like Dick or his wife, and then in college, there was Dick Rootschilling, who was actually from Dayton. He was in the wedding, and then Lynn Korn. Of course, Dick was working as a geologist, and then went to work for 3M up in Minneapolis, and he's still there, but his parents died, and I haven't seen him, but I haven't attempted. I probably, one of those things you probably ought to contact a whole bunch of them and find out what's going on. So of all those people, Lynn Korn's the only one who stayed with, but because your mother likes cats. Makes all the difference in the world if your mother likes and doesn't like.
Well, she makes a lot of the effort to touch, but she writes the letter.
Yes, but she also is very negative about doing things when she doesn't. I mean, she didn't like Dave Barber particularly and didn't care for his wife, so that fell by the wayside here. It's just, I guess it's easy to go with the world.
All right,
I'll
ask you a couple short questions and I'll The word, yeah.
have another home. I think I said he's working in that steel fabrication.
He got fired?
Got fired because the machine kept breaking down and I didn't have anything to do, so I took a nap. I mean, you can only sweep up so much of the, I mean, you're sitting in this room, about the size of this room, you know, shorter and wider, and you were standing on a steel grate, and you had a, like a conveyor, not a conveyor belt, a bunch of motorized rollers, and they would bring these 2 foot all steel beams of all various sizes, and it was a machine that they had bought, used, and I don't know if they hadn't learned how to make it run properly, but what you did is you were in full gear with piped in air, and you had leather chaps and leather, a leather coat and leather sleeves, and this big mask over your head with air pumping in, and you had a hose about 2 inches in diameter with a steel tip on the end, and steel shot came out of this at, I don't know how many hundreds of pounds of pressure. And two guys, one on either side, sat there, and you sandblasted or shot blasted these beams as they were going through, and the shot and everything just fell through the big grate and was recirculated, supposedly crud that was in it, and it kept breaking down, and your mother was on a, her flying schedule was such that she was coming in late most nights, so then I would stay up until she came in, and we weren't getting a lot of sleep, and I had to be there at 6 in the morning, and I mean, I tended to be there on time, I believe, that wasn't an issue, but the thing would break down, and I mean, you would sweep up the interior of the place, and everything was clean, and it still wasn't working, and I go over, sit in the corner, and take a nap. They got bent out of shape about it, and actually, it was probably a good thing it was a, because when you weren't doing it with the steel shot, the way they had been cleaning it, they would take, you were in this great big monstrous steel side, you know, just a steel jet, but very high, big overhead cranes and stuff, and they would take slag from the steel mills, which is this black that got crushed up and glassy, and there, because it wasn't as abrasive, they, what they did is they just had it laid out in great big, they would lay the steel out, and you would walk back and forth, and it would just, the stuff would fall on the ground as you shot blasted, and then after, you know, I don't know how often they did it, but you'd sit there and then they would flip them or whatever, I forget the exact procedures, but you were dealing with this black dust, and all you wore was a hood with the air over you at the time then. You didn't need the other, I mean, there was just no way to be clean. And after I got fired, I literally drove out of there, or walk, I probably walked, because your mother would have dropped me off and then gone to fly that day. Of course, she had to have a car. And I walked out, and they were constructing an addition to a hotel, a 3 or 4 story hotel, right on the flight path. I mean, the flights were landing about 100 yards north of us at O'Hare. It was that close. And this was like a 4 or 5 story addition. And they were bricking it. And of course, I had worked with brick masons in Rochester, and I'd, you know, much rather be outdoors. And right. So I stopped by, and I still had my union laborer's card, International Union of Hod Carriers, some common laborers, or whatever the hell it was. And Lefty Helgeson, it was a small, it was him, his brother-in-law, and like 2 other masons, and there was a younger guy my age who I think was also, may have been a relative or had known him. And I said, hey, you know, I'm looking for work. You need any help? I, you know, I know how to carry brick and help build scaffolding. And he said, yeah. And it was a much better job. And then I was outdoors. It was kind of the difference between working for AT&T and working for Riverside.
So I spent the rest of the summer there. It was a much, I think I actually got paid more money. And I got a lot more hours, and it was much more interesting because, of course, planes were landing all day.
The best job.
Oh, I think probably TAP. Satisfaction and independence and responsibility. The only thing I never got out of that job is a promotion. And that's just good and bad of George. Because I was just talking to one of the women that left, that George wouldn't even promote to GS7 or whatever it was. And I, in some ways, she's a very nice woman. And I think sometimes she comes across as being a little, simple is not quite the word, but a little airy maybe. But she's got her 12. She left TAP and went to work for other offices, and she said she may get her 13. So she may be a bit of an airhead or something, but she's obviously doing some of the work. She's competent enough. But she said, you know, it still makes me mad. She said, you had all that work and all that responsibility, and George still never gave you a promotion. She said, it makes me so mad. I mean, I'm like, well, yeah, I didn't know you cared about him. But Don is really a nice, caring person.
Your first car.
1962 Buick Special 4-door V6. Speed manual transmission, no air conditioning.
Did you buy it, or was it a new one?
Oh, I bought it used.
In your college? No,
yes. I hitchhiked the first 2 years. We bought it at the beginning of my junior year. The deal was, when I was working at Bausch & Lomb Foundry and then working construction out of the college, that's probably the one time Dad actually used his influence. Speaking of that, was when they were building the college, and I mean, it was a giant construction project. I mean, there were like 12 buildings, because they took the old county prison farm, and over the course of 3 years, built an entire college, or 2 years, built an entire college campus, probably 10 or 12 buildings out of nothing. So, I mean, it was a major job. I worked there 2 summers and one break. But anyway, shouldn't diverge like that because we're talking about a car. Deal was, all the money I earned went into the account. My parents took all my money other than spending money, and that went in to help pay towards college. Now, I didn't have to pay any extra for college, and they gave me, I got spending money, especially freshman year, and when I finally got a job on campus, I know I got, junior year I was a dorm resident, junior year, but anyway, all the money went into pay for this stuff, and I could get rides. There was a couple guys from Rochester who had cars, and I would get rides. I only hitchhiked St. Joe actually once or twice. Only once to go home. I did a lot of hitchhiking to get to places around the Midwest. But by junior year, they were gone, and I made the point that I could make $60 each way. I think it was $30 each way per kid, and that's what I paid when I went to someone. And by that point, Bill Wills, who was a dad, he was my best man, and of course he wasn't my best man then, but Dad had met him through one of his friends from college who was one of the seven blocks of Granite at Fordham, along with Vince Lombardi, which probably doesn't mean a whole lot to you, but Vince Lombardi was, okay. This was one of his teammates who was a probation officer in Rochester. Dad somehow ran across him. And Bill Wills was a friend of his, and that's how we got involved with Bill Wills, sold cars and stuff. So anyway, by June, I was agitating to some extent. So by that point, I was making like $4.50 an hour working construction. And I mean, I was working. Oh, yeah, my sister, BJ, was pissed because she was a nurse in the emergency room, the busiest emergency room in New York outside of the city. And she was only making like $3.50 an hour. And she was quite perturbed about that. But so that year I was probably making, let's see, $4 an hour. I was making $200 a week plus overtime and there was yada, yada, yada. And so anyway, the deal was I was allowed to take some of the money and Bill Wills picked the car out for me. And of course, it was small enough that it wasn't real expensive to drive, but it was big enough I could fit. Well, I put five people in. I guess it wasn't. It seemed small in comparison to the giant boats that you had back in the 60s, but it wasn't, probably wasn't that small. Because I know I carried at least four people in it. But we drove that for 66 until the years of college and a year down in Texas. And then water pump, something was going bad. And of course, I didn't work on cars at that point, nor did I have a place or tools to work on it. And that's when we bought our Ford, which was our first new car, right? The Ford Fairlane, if you remember.
And then, what's the best car you ever had?
Well, somewhat prejudiced, I would say either my current truck or the van. I think the van is a hell of a vehicle. Mm-hmm. Would have liked to have had a manual transmission. But I thought the van doesn't meet our requirements now, but I guess probably the van. Your mother, of course, would say the 79 Fairlane, or
yeah,
79 Elm.
I love that car. Frank said a VW bug.
I never would have thought of him in a VW.
I never would have seen him in a VW bug. All right.
There's something about your kids. It was a dark and stormy night, Mike, much like this, the Saturday we had in last week when you had the party for it. The difference was it didn't stop snowing at noon, it kept right on snowing. And I had been, it was senior year and at Aquinas, and I was dating, technically, on two different girls, from two different girls' schools. One was Pat Benazinski, Small World, because her parents owned the diner that I used to eat at when I was at Bao Shalom, because they didn't know it at the time. And the other one was Phyllis Contestable, who went to Mercy, who was a very good singer, eventually became a professional jazz singer and stuff, never made it. A lot of people do well and earn a living, but never, you know, make it real big. And as there was they called it the victory dance or whatever, there was always that dance at the end of the football season, because there were no dances or anything until football was over with Aquinas. And, of course, I had to ask one or the other, and I asked Phyllis instead of Pat, which, of course, pissed Pat off and put an end to that. And the night after the dance, when I took Phyllis home, she's the one who told me, well, it wouldn't be fair to continue to go out with me because she was going into convent. And so that was, I mean,
you blew both
relationships were in the toilet. And, And what had happened, that happened a week after, it was probably 1 or 2 weeks after the end of football season. At the end of the last game of the year, which was a home game, we had a big party at someone's house out in up on North St. Paul, out towards Shalott, but actually on the other side of the river. And Phyllis at the same time was in a play at Mercy. They had their, you know, like, and they had a big, they were big productions, every bit as big as what you guys did for like Bye Bye Birdie and things like that, Oklahoma. And they were having their cast party. Because it was, we always played our games at Aquinas on Sundays, because we told you that whole thing about filling the stadium and all that. And they still had 8,000 people coming to the games back then. And, of course, she wanted to go to the cast party, and I didn't have a car then. For some reason, I didn't have the use of any of the cars, or the car that we had at that point. And, so I went out to the party with someone, and to get a ride home, Bill Euling, who was a teammate of mine, was dating Irene.